Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sack here, and today I'm very pleased to be bringing you a podcast episode that explores the latest developments in RET-driven thyroid cancer that were presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO's 2021 virtual conference. The session has been sponsored by an educational grant from Eli Lilly and is hosted by Dr. Bridget Scott, a freelance medical writer from MyYAS Editorial Services. Sharing their key takeaways from ASCO are two fantastic speakers. First, we have Dr. Nicola Normano from the Department of Cellular Biology and Biotherapy at the Istituto Nazionale Tumori in Napoli, Italy. You'll also hear from Dr. Jonathan Wadsley from Western Park Hospital in Sheffield, here in the United Kingdom. The two experts will discuss the latest efficacy and safety data in patients with RET-driven thyroid cancer, RET testing, and finally, the future of RET-driven diseases, examining the potential effects of these developments on clinical practice and patient outcomes. If you are well-versed in RET-driven thyroid cancer or looking to learn more, this one's for you. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Nicola Normano and Professor John Wadsley. Let's start with a background question. What is the RET gene and how has its discovery impacted on the understanding, research and treatment of thyroid cancer? Nicola, would you like to start us off?
Sure. The RET gene encodes for a transmembrane receptor tyrosine kinase, and actually this gene was discovered for the first time as a potential oncogene in 1985. Later on in 1990, it was found that about 10 to 20% of patients with papillary thyroid cancer do carry fusions of RET. And these fusions are usually the consequence of rearrangements, genomic rearrangements. In particular, most frequently are invasion on chromosome 10 that lead to the fusion of some regions of the RET genes with regions of another gene. Usually the region of the RET gene that is involved in fusion is the kinase domain, whereas the partner gene carries sequences that favor the dimerization of the receptor. In fact, receptor dimerization is essential for the activation of tyrosine kinase receptors. And when we have these fusion proteins, what happens is that these receptors are constitutively dimerized, and this leads to constitutive activation of the signaling of the kinase and the signaling pathways that are activated by the kinase. And finally, this will lead to increased proliferation, survival, and transformation of thyroid cells. The frequency, as I said, of these fusions is 10 to 20% in papillary thyroid cancers, is much less frequent in other subtypes of thyroid cancer, and it is almost never found in medullary thyroid cancer. However, in medullary thyroid cancer, we can find another type of genomic alteration of the RET gene, in particular somatic mutations of RET. Now, these mutations actually can be either germline or somatic, depending on whether we are dealing with hereditary medullary thyroid cancer or with forms of sporadic medullary thyroid cancer. In the hereditary form, we have a germline RET mutations, whereas in the somatic, in the sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, we have of course, somatic mutations of RET in approximately 55% of the cases. And this, of course, as the discovery of this mutation has significantly impacted on what is the diagnostic and therapeutic approach to thyroid cancer. And I think that this has been a very important innovation for oncologists and endocrinologists who take care of patients with thyroid cancer. Is this true, John?
Yes, absolutely. So now that we have drugs that are specifically targeted to these alterations, it's really important that we understand about them, and I'm sure discuss as we go along. There are now very effective treatments that could very effectively target these changes.
Thank you both for a fantastic introduction. So where do RET inhibitors fit in the treatment of patients with RET fusion positive thyroid cancer and RET mutant medullary thyroid cancer? John, if you'd like to comment on that.
Certainly. So RET inhibitors are drugs that have been specifically and very cleverly designed to specifically inhibit RET alterations in cells. So these treatments are only of use if the patient actually has a tumour with a RET alteration. So the first thing with this is absolutely critical to be undertaking the testing for patients with advanced thyroid cancer to understand whether patients with medullary thyroid cancer have RET gene mutations, as Nicola has just been describing, or whether patients with other thyroid cancers have RET gene fusions. So critical that we understand whether that abnormality is present first. But if we do find patients with thyroid cancer and RET alterations, then these inhibitors are a really important new treatment option. At the moment, the only licensed agent in Europe, selpercatinib, is available for second-line treatment of these patients, so after treatment has failed with first-line multikinase inhibitors. So that's where the treatments are positioned at the moment, although there is ongoing work and there are ongoing trials looking at the use of these agents in the first-line setting as well.
Nicola, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, it's peculiar that these drugs are working also in patients that have been previously treated with multi-case inhibitors, in particular for RET altered medullary thyroid cancer, because these patients receive a first-line treatment with agents that are able to block a number of different kinases, including the RET kinase. So what we might hypothesize is that basically, when the patients become resistant to this first line treatment with multikinase inhibitors, they do not develop mechanism of resistance that also will lead to resistance to more specific inhibitors such as selpercatinib. And this is actually has been shown. In fact, there are some mutations, acquired mutations of RET that have been demonstrated to be developed by patients after treatment with multikinase inhibitors, and many of these mutations have been found in preclinical and clinical studies to be sensitive to selpercatinib. Nevertheless, we must also assume that it's possible that after treatment with these multikinase inhibitors, some patient might develop some peculiar genomic alteration, might lead to resistance also to selpercatinib as well. And so I think that in the next future, will be more and more important to use maybe liquid biopsy to really to track the genomic evolution of the tumor of these patients during treatment, either with the multikinase inhibitors or later with the selpercatinib or praseltinib or other specific inhibitors, because in this way we can really understand which are the mechanisms of acquired resistance, and we can predict really better to which drug our patient might respond. So this will improve our possibility to provide a precision medicine treatment to all our patients.
John, would you like to comment on the use of liquid biopsies sort of from the clinical side?
Certainly. So this is a really exciting potential development. I have to say, I think it's still very much in a sort of experimental stage in thyroid cancer. But this is basically the concept of being able to detect cancer cells in the bloodstream and actually undertake molecular analysis to detect mutations in those cancer cells. And as Nicola's suggested, this might actually enable us to, in a sort of more real-time fashion, track what's happening with the genetic alterations in thyroid cancer cells and see new mutations that might lead to treatment resistance developing. So this is obviously, it's much more feasible to do this from a blood test than it would be taking repeated biopsies from the patient's tumour. So yes, I think this is a really interesting development, and I'm aware, you know, I have colleagues in the UK who are working on this in advanced thyroid cancer. I think something to keep an eye on for the future, but unfortunately not something that's ready to be used just now.
And if I can add to this, is that liquid biopsy for sure is not the preferred approach to detect, in particular, gene fusions in patients that must undergo treatment with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Nevertheless, if there are patients in which tissue is not available, liquid biopsy could be used to detect the fusions or mutations. There are data out there that suggest that by using NGS testing or liquid biopsy, you can really detect also these complex genomic alterations. So liquid biopsy is not the preferred option, but if you have no tissue available, is a possibility to be used to detect the genomic alteration that might predict response to type of the agent.
Thank you for your insight. Up to 80% of patients with sporadic medullary thyroid cancer have somatic M918T RET mutations. What is the clinical significance of these mutations and how do they impact prognosis? Nicola, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, sure. In patients with sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, this mutation is usually associated with a more aggressive disease and worse prognosis. The patients with this mutation often have larger tumors, multifocal tumors, involvement of lymph nodes or distant metastasis, and therefore usually it's really associated with a shorter overall survival of these patients. However, what I want to highlight is that the presence of this mutation does predict response to tyrosine kinase inhibitors, in particular to selpercatinib, but also fraseltinib. So if this is a very bad prognostic factor on one end, on the other hand, the presence of this mutation will predict also response to tyrosine kinase inhibitors, so providing to these patients an important chance of treatment. And I think this has been really a great innovation on high, that highlights the impact that precision medicine can have in different tumor types, including thyroid cancer. And I think this is something that's very important for oncologists, of course, for patients with thyroid cancer. John, what do you think about?
Yes, so I absolutely agree, Nicola. You know, so we know this particular mutation, which, you know, as we've pointed out, is the most common in sporadic medullary thyroid cancer, is associated with the worst prognosis. But we know that there's certainly good evidence that it does predict for benefit from the multikinase inhibitors. And we also know that with the new RET inhibitors, patients with this specific mutation still benefit from the drug, that there's still value to be gained from treatment with selpercatinib. So although overall, their baseline prognosis is worse, these patients still benefit from these new drugs.
Thank you, John. Selpercatinib and praseltinib have been reported to show robust, durable antitumor activity in patients with multiple RET fusion positive, heavily pretreated advanced solid tumors. These data have been suggested to highlight the need for broad RET testing to identify candidates who may benefit from treatment with RET inhibitors. Is such a proposal realistic? How would broad RET testing be conducted? John, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, I think we really are in thyroid cancer, we're entering an area of very personalized genomic medicine. You know, we're not just actually interested in RET alterations, although they are really important, as we've been hearing this afternoon. But also there are other genetic alterations such as NTRK fusions, which are targetable. And we know are relatively common in our patient population. So I think it is really important that we are thinking about undertaking molecular testing in patients, particularly with advanced thyroid cancer, who may benefit from these treatments. And I think it is realistic that we can aim to test these patients. Advanced thyroid cancer is not terribly common, but in those patients who do have either advanced iodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer or medullary thyroid cancer, it is perfectly possible now to undertake this molecular genetic analysis so we can determine whether patients have genetic alterations that are targetable. So yeah, absolutely, I think it's really important. And you know, I think this sort of situation is already very well embedded in other sorts of lung cancer. So perhaps lung cancer might be the best example of this, where, you know, there are a number of genetic alterations that are routinely tested for now in patients with lung cancer to identify targetable changes. And I don't see any reason why we can't do the same in thyroid cancer.
Nicola, would you like to comment?
Yeah, actually, we are entering in the era of tumor-agnostic biomarkers and tumor-agnostic drugs. However, to address these issues is very difficult. Many of these genomic alterations are quite rare in the majority of the tumor types. And of course, the problem is how to address the issue, identify patients that carry these rare genetic alterations. Now, red fusions are particularly difficult to detect because for other fusions, for example, in TRAC, we have available immunohistochemistry, at least as a screen, the first level screen, and then we can use maybe NGS or FISH to confirm the presence of the fusion. In the case of RET, we do not have up to now any good immunohistochemistry test that we can use at least as first level screen. So we should go with FISH or maybe with NGS for patients. And of course, the cost and of this will be very high if you think to the very low frequency of these fusions, at least in most of solid cancer. So I think that pragmatically, what will happen is that we will screen for RET fusion tumors other than thyroid cancer, lung cancer, of course, or only in those tumors in which NGS is already planned for other reasons. So if you are using an NGS panel, most likely this panel will cover also RET fusions. So in other tumors, in other patients, maybe we will start to screen for RET fusions only if patients are in advanced phase or they are refractory to treatments or peculiar clinical condition. Although this will be, of course, in the clinical practice, although in the academic centers, we are already using large panels, so many of our patients will be screened for RET fusion independently from their histological background. Of course, we'll need to wait for the results of the prospective clinical trials that are ongoing before we can really affirm that a patient that carries a RET fusion might respond to treatment to a RET inhibitor independently from histology. This need to be demonstrated, and therefore I would discourage, you know, colleagues to treat patients with RET inhibitors outside of clinical trials. We need to treat patients in the clinical trials because only through the clinical trials we will increase our knowledge really on the correlation between presence of these fusions and response to treatment with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and these will move on the field. And finally, we may get to approval of this biomarker and its matched drugs as tumor agnostic.
Thank you, Nicola. How well tolerated are selpercatinib and pirazotinib in patients with RET-altered thyroid cancers, and what strategies are used to limit or manage any side effects? John?
So the data that's reported for both of these agents suggests really that they're both generally very well tolerated. There are some reported side effects, but generally they're grade 1 or grade 2 toxicities in the majority of cases, so generally manageable. And there's a low rate of treatment discontinuation due to adverse events, so typically reported treatment discontinuation in the order of, sort of 5 or 6% of patients, which compares very favourably with some of the other treatments that we use in advanced thyroid cancer, where treatment discontinuation rates due to side effects can be as high as 20%. So yes, these drugs do seem to be well tolerated. There are one or two things that do need careful monitoring to ensure that patients can stay on treatment and benefit from the treatment for as long as possible. So, for example, they can cause hypertension. So blood pressure does need to be monitored, but generally this is manageable with standard antihypertensive drugs. They can cause elevations in transaminases, so liver function tests do need monitoring. But again, with appropriate treatment pauses and dose adjustments, they can generally be managed. We do also, for some of these agents, also need to monitor for QTc prolongation. But again, as long as ECGs are undertaken and monitored, that's not problematic. So yeah, in general, these drugs do seem to be well tolerated. And as long as the appropriate careful monitoring is in place, patients can tolerate them for long periods of time.
That all sounds very positive. Thank you, John. So when would you test for RET in patients with advanced thyroid cancer? And would you conduct RET testing for all advanced thyroid cancer patients? Now, Nicola, you touched on this earlier. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, sure. Actually, it's not the easy question to address because we have to make clear first which is the role of RET in the pathogenesis of thyroid cancer. Now, we assume that RET is a driver oncogene that is relevant in the pathogenesis of the disease. which means we believe that this is an early event, a common event that will be present in 100% of cancer cells, more or less. So if we assume that this is a trial event, clonal event and a clonal mutation, we assume that this mutation might not be lost during the treatment or during the course of the disease. The clonal mutation will be always there. This is why I think that we can really test for RAS genomic alteration from the early diagnosis of a thyroid cancer, because the mutation is going to be there. I mean, whatever treatment you will do. Of course, one problem comes from those patients who might receive RAS kinase inhibitors, even though they are multi-kinase inhibitors as first line, because at this point they might develop some resistance mutations. As I told before, most patients, as also John commented, the majority of patients that are treated in first line with the multi-kinase inhibitor still will respond to second line specific treatment with the selpercatinib, and therefore I think that, you know, it's still true that we should test the patients first line, even because in this way we already have available, you know, the data about regarding the genomic alteration of the patients, and so we can really plan for a second line of target therapy. Nevertheless, I mean, if patients receive a first line multi-kinase inhibitor that is also inhibitor of RET, I mean, I do believe that in the future the addition of liquid biopsy after progression of the disease why really provide additional information that can help to tailor better the treatment of our patients.
John, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, so, you know, as Nicola said, RET alterations we know do tend to be early events in the development of thyroid cancers, so they are likely to be there from an early stage. So whilst I wouldn't advocate testing for these alterations in every patient with thyroid cancer, clearly many thyroid cancer patients are cured with surgery and radioiodine treatment and don't get to the advanced stage. But in our practice, we are now testing every patient who has developed advanced thyroid cancer. So either advanced iodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer or advanced medullary thyroid cancer. We test them as soon as they reach that point, so we know what the treatment options are. As I mentioned earlier, these RET inhibitors, well, the only licensed RET inhibitor so far is only available for second line use, but I still think it's really useful to know if that is going to be a treatment option for your patient before you start first line multi-kinase inhibitors, because I think knowing that there is a highly active second line treatment option, I think may well influence decisions about when to switch treatment. So for example, if a patient is really struggling with their first line multi-kinase inhibitor with toxicity, you might be more ready to change to a different drug if you know there is a very active treatment option. So yeah, I think it's worth doing the testing at an early stage in the pathway of patients with advanced disease.
And if I can add on this, I mean, I fully agree with John, because you know the strategy from the beginning. Of course, what the guidelines suggest up to now is that you should screen for RET fusions in all the different histotypes of thyroid cancer, with the exception of the medullary thyroid cancer, whereas, you know, you should screen for RET mutations only in medullary thyroid cancer, just, you know, to give clear indication on when screening, which types of genomic alterations you should screen your patients.
Thank you, Nicola. Thank you, John. The EMA has approved selpercatinib in patients with advanced RET fusion positive thyroid cancer who require systemic therapy following prior treatment with sorafenib and or lenvatinib, and in RET mutant medullary thyroid cancer who require systemic therapy following prior treatment with cabozantinib and or vandetanib. Now, John, you've already started to explain about the impact of this approval on the treatment paradigm in RET-altered thyroid cancer. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the sort of the first-line treatment and bringing in these second-line treatments for the thyroid cancer patient?
So, yeah, so we did already have these fairly active first-line treatments, both for iodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer and medullary thyroid cancer, but the benefit is of limited duration. So it's really important that we now have potentially a further line of treatment for these patients with RET alterations who have exhausted all other lines of licensed therapy. And what's impressive about these agents is that they do seem to show very impressive efficacy with very durable responses and very well tolerated, even in patients who have been pre-treated with these multi-kinase inhibitors. So I think what will be really interesting is to see the results of the further ongoing research using these agents in the first line setting. But certainly as things stand at the moment, I think this is a really important development and really good news for patients being able to access second line treatment when they have RET altered thyroid cancers.
Nicola, would you like to add anything?
I think that the multi-kinase inhibitors have been really important for patients with thyroid cancer, but now the introduction of these drugs that are matched to specific genomic alteration really introduced the concept of precision medicine in thyroid cancer. And we expect that we might have available additional drugs in the next future, in addition to novel RET inhibitors that might be active also in patients that develop resistant mutations to current inhibitors. We are now in advanced phase of clinical experimentation also RAS inhibitors, and we know that about 40%, for example, of patients with sporadic medullary thyroid cancer carry RAS mutation, RB RAS or KRAS. So I think that this is just a field that is starting, but we will have more and more chance to treat our patients with targeted agents if we will introduce genomic screening in the routine clinical practice also for patients with thyroid cancer.
Finally, what are the potential effects of these latest developments on clinical practice and patient outcomes? What does the future of RET-driven thyroid cancer diagnosis and treatment with RET inhibitors look like? John, would you like to address that?
Yeah, thank you. So, well, I think one of the key implications is that as we said earlier, we need to be testing our patients' thyroid cancer samples for these genetic alterations to work out whether they are suitable to try these really exciting novel treatments. So we need to be establishing those networks to ensure that we can do that molecular genetic testing. And as I've said earlier, again, not just for RET, but other targetable alterations such as NTRK fusions. If we don't do the test, we won't know which patients are going to benefit. But once we have identified patients with these alterations, and specifically with RET alterations, I think, although the data is relatively immature so far, it is looking very promising that these drugs will provide very long-term control for these patients' cancers, improve symptoms, improve quality of life, but extend survival, we hope. So I think this is a really important development.
Nicola, would you like to comment?
I'm just saying that I fully agree with John, and I do believe that this drug will have a significant impact on the outcome of patients with thyroid cancer, although we need to collect more data. And I think that by having available additional drugs, additional inhibitors, and screening our patients, we really can improve the outcome of patients with thyroid cancer. On the other hand, we have examples already in lung cancer and other tumor types in which the genomic profiling and availability of matched drugs has significantly improved the outcome of patients, and I'm confident this will be also achieved in thyroid cancer.
Thank you both. That was a very interesting discussion of the latest developments in RET-driven thyroid cancer. Thank you very much, Nicola and John, for your stimulating insights into this intriguing subject.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that concludes our podcast and summary of the latest findings in RET-driven thyroid cancer presented at ASCO 2021 virtual conference. A big thank you to our host, Dr. Bridget Scott, and our two experts, Dr. Nicola Normano and Dr. Jonathan Wadsley, for sharing their thoughts and insights. If you found this episode insightful, head over to our podcast hub at www.emg-health.com. I'll say that again, that's www.emg-health.com, where we have plenty of other episodes like this, including the first podcast in this series, which explores the latest developments from ASCO in RET-driven lung cancer. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.